Does the United States government use social media to censor the speech of its citizenry? Can it? Really? With election season upon us, can the United States government use search engines to influence public opinion? Can it? Actually? Should we trust big tech platforms like TikTok, X, Instagram, Google, and Facebook with our personal photographs and stories of our families? Can we trust the news content we discover on these platforms? Do U.S. citizens have constitutionally protected digital liberties? Is our freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and the free exchange of ideas online safeguarded?
The media institutions are dependent on the government money because that is what protects them against competition from alternative media, and that is what protects their monopoly in terms of Google search results or in Facebook news feeds. The government is, it's an instrument of statecraft. It's a multi-billion dollar industry for a reason, because it's about control of society and commercial interests and political interests at the very heart of it all.
On this episode of Some Future Day, Mike Benz joins me to tackle these new tech social issues and helps us get a grasp as to what is actually happening in the digital realm. Mr. Mike Benz is a former U.S. Department of State official, where he held the position of Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Communications and Information Policy in the Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs. That role included formulating and negotiating U.S. policy on cyber issues and interfacing with private industry and civil society institutions in the technology space, big tech social media included. Today, Mr. Benz is the executive director of the Foundation for Freedom Online, a nonprofit watchdog dedicated to protecting digital liberties and restoring the free and open internet. In many ways, my discussion with Mike is difficult to believe. That said, it's extremely important, and I implore you to take the time and listen closely as Mike provides a ton of context and explanation. Mike, thank you for being my guest on Some Future Day. All right. I am so thrilled to have you, Mike Benz, on Some Future Day today. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Good, good. So, Mike, your background is really interesting and impressive, and I would imagine that it's provided you with a tremendous amount of firsthand insight and intelligence as to what we're about to speak about. So can you explain exactly what your title and role in the State Department was?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful. It was Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Communications and Information Technology in the Economic Bureau of the State Department. So what that is basically, you know, the Economic Bureau has to deal with our economic diplomacy, our soft power projection on the rest of the world. We have a hard power projection with our military. The soft power is principally run out of the State Department. And international communications and information technology is basically a long way of just saying the internet. So there's a lot of cyber diplomacy that the U.S. does, because so much of commerce runs through the internet. You know, sometime around a decade ago, big tech surpassed big oil as being the largest companies in the world. And so we have U.S. national champions like Google and Apple and Microsoft and Facebook that depend on the long arm of the U.S. government via the State Department to do diplomacy on their behalf in order to protect them against foreign laws that might impact their interests, which would impact American jobs or export markets. And so I sat at the desk that basically governed cyber diplomacy in the economic space in 2020.
So when you talk about soft power, I'm sorry to take you back for a second, but can you just quickly give our audience the definition of soft power?
So soft power is a influence projection done using either economic or informational or cultural means in order to influence the internal politics of a foreign country to make that ecosystem there more favorable for interests here. So for example, if there is a law that a foreign government's parliament is considering passing, that might impact U.S. multinational companies, and that would force U.S. companies to, you know, kill jobs or hurt their profits because of labor issues or tariffs or whatnot. The State Department would then negotiate with that foreign government on behalf, essentially, of U.S. national champions in order to put pressure on that country's government. Another classic soft power projection mechanism is media. So after World War II, we being the US, the UK, and then, you know, NATO, essentially, we created this transatlantic rules-based international order. And in order to take on communism in the 20th century, there were many media proprietaries, in-house media organizations that were funded by the State Department or controlled by the Central Intelligence Agency. These were groups like Radio Free Europe or Radio Liberty or Radio Free Asia or Voice of America. You may have heard of some of these. They're currently said to be independent because of operational transfer about a generation ago, but these all started as being run out of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the State Department funds thousands of media organizations in basically every country around the globe in order to have U.S. favorable information projected and piped into foreign countries where U.S. national interests are not necessarily represented.
So these media entities were effectively independent from the United States government, advancing the United States government overseas policy, but were funded by our government.
Yes. Yes. You can think of them as, today we would call them GONGOs, government-organized non-governmental organizations. They're essentially cutouts, and their principal function is to sway hearts and minds. You know, after the Age of Empire ended in 1948, we had the UN Declaration on Human Rights, which prevented classical empire building through military capture. We, you know, this rules-based international order that I described has international laws that prohibit the territorial annexation by military force. And so what you need to have today to have basically, you know, a recognized government is some sort of democratic ratification. And projection of soft power became a much bigger role of the State Department, the CIA, and the Pentagon than purely military or paramilitary force. And so the importance of government-funded NGOs, government-funded independent media organizations to sway hearts and minds became a huge part of our theater of soft war, if you will.
I've heard you speak before about how the United States government created effectively a three-legged strategic alliance between the State Department, the Department of Defense, and the Central Intelligence Agency to kind of drive that soft power overseas. Can you talk a little bit about that infrastructure within the United States government, that three-legged enterprise mm-hmm. that you mentioned?
Yeah, so you can think of it as diplomacy, defense, and intelligence. And these are three capacities within the U.S. government that are supposed to be strictly foreign-facing. You know, I mentioned, you know, the world really changed in 1948. That's when the Central Intelligence Agency was established. That was when we renamed the Department of War to the Department of Defense to make it basically look like we were no longer engaged in offensive action, but forward defensive action. And, you know, there's a 1948 memo by George Kennan, who's one of the godfathers of the CIA, called The Inauguration of Organized Political Warfare, that basically lays out how the U.S. in the late 1940s our foreign policy establishment decided that we needed a Department of Dirty Tricks to be able to engage in this kind of wily soft power projection, and that it would be concentrated within these federal agencies that would not be able to touch U.S. citizens. You can almost think of it like a guard dog or a pit bull that defends your house on the outside, but isn't necessarily allowed to come in because it's a very dangerous animal. Which is to say that these three agencies, if you will, although that it's more the intelligence community, you know, all 17 of those I just say CIA is a sort of shorthand proxy for that. They're not allowed to operate on U.S. soil. The State Department can't operate on U.S. soil. The Defense Department can't. They can't target U.S. citizens. You know, the CIA can't. Now, there's of course a little dirty trick there when they use the word counterintelligence to do so. But leaving that loophole aside, they're all supposed to be foreign facing, and they all have a different set of skills that they bring to the table. So the State Department those three entities combined. You know, the foreign policy establishment is the way they're referred to in Washington. They're sometimes also called the blob. This was the term that President Obama's deputy national security advisor Ben Rhodes used to describe this structure within Washington. I think I use that term as well. I think it's a helpful shorthand. Folks within the blob lovingly use the phrase the blob as well. Victoria Nuland's husband, Robert Kagan, his counsel to President Biden a week before the election was respect the blob, learn from the blob, love the blob. He wrote that as his three word, this is three sentence counsel to President Biden in Brookings just a week before the previous election. But this is something that you can argue played a really important role in American prosperity in the 20th century. The State Department is the formal entity that goes and negotiates with a foreign country's government, and it can offer carrots and sticks in order to influence that government's decisions, to get them to pass a bill, to get them to kill a bill, to get them to take to open up their society to allow U.S. favorable media in, to not do police crackdowns on dissident groups who might be backed by the U.S. government. These sorts of things are negotiated by the U.S. State Department. That's their overt side of U.S. diplomacy. Now, the State Department is always synchronized with the activities of the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency through something we call the interagency process, which is basically the consensus of foreign policy establishment institutions that's technically coordinated out of the White House National Security Council. But what you have is this overt, this sort of visible side of the iceberg, if you will, that represents the State Department. But the ambassador and the senior level State Department officials are constantly coordinating with the underside of the iceberg, which is our covert diplomacy work, our covert influence work, which is done through the intelligence community. So that's how the CIA sort of comes into the picture, which is that the CIA was created under a doctrine that's called plausible deniability, which is the idea that they have a license to do certain kinds of underhanded deeds, certain kinds of things like election, engineering, control over media organizations, working with various dissident groups, the sorts of things that if the State Department was caught doing it and it was formally attributed to the U.S. government, it would be a diplomatic scandal. And there would be a tremendous amount of blowback. When it's done in a deniable fashion, then that allows the State Department to operate at maximum efficiency because they can say one thing while under the iceberg they're doing something else. So the State Department constantly has to be apprised of what the CIA is doing in the region in order to maximize what they can do diplomatically and to be able to ask for the right things in negotiations and whatnot. And the Pentagon comes into the picture with in two fashions, the sort of hard power, latent threat in a region, which is to say, if you don't do what the State Department tells you to do, and the CIA is being ineffective at being able to do soft power influence, we can come in with hard power, and we can seize a particular territory, we can put troops on the border, we can, do any number of formal Pentagon activity. But then there's also a civil affairs branch of the Pentagon, which does a lot of this hearts and minds work that's sort of shared with the Central Intelligence Agency. And the Pentagon is by far the biggest federal agency that we have. It's the most highest funded. So these three things are constantly in sync.
So just to be clear though, Mike, the blob is really originally built to look outside and to function outside of the United States.
Yes, it is. And again, you can make the argument that the blob was a wonderful thing in the 20th century and that today it serves an important function. There are competing schools of foreign policy on this that I think are reasonable on both sides, which is to say, so the oil and gas industry is a famous example of the intertwining of the foreign policy establishment, the blob, and U.S. commercial interests, right? So the work that the U.S. classically did in the 20th century to overthrow foreign governments in order to, have influence over their oil fields, their shale reserves, is something that allowed Exxon and Chevron and Mobil and Halliburton and Phillips Conoco to all become these, top of the food chain market cap companies. It's maybe the reason we actually had cheap gas, something like 3 to 4 times cheaper gas than Europe did for the entire 20th century. You can make the argument that American jobs, the reason we had such middle-class prosperity relative to the rest of the world was because our commercial interests, which were pried open by the Central Intelligence Agency, which were you know, which opposition was sanctioned by the State Department, or our U.S. military stepped in to protect those investments, is the reason that we had, you know, the kind of middle class jobs that we had all over, you know, from the heartland to the South to California in America in the 20th century. And one of the reasons that we had the export markets we did, because we were able to pry open foreign countries to make sure that they were buying, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, and they were buying U.S. steel, and they were allowing us to mine their copper and aluminum and gold and lithium and cobalt. I mean, even today, you know, green energy, this green energy revolution, you know, is a very hot topic that relies on two critical minerals, lithium and cobalt. You know, 85% of the world's cobalt is basically in Congo. What happens if the blob does not, you know, break out its Department of Dirty Tricks to be able to have representation for access to cobalt? Well, then there goes, you know, any sort of U.S. commercial capacity to move forward with renewable batteries. So, you know, there's a complex interplay here. My concern comes with when the blob basically decided to use that special set of skills that it had in the domestic setting, which was what it was doing here in the U.S. in the 1960s.
That's what I was going to get at.
Wasn't it
like early on? So it's interesting because your seat, your vantage point from within the State Department allowed for you. You were at the center of essentially like technology and the way that new media is existing today as it relates to social media search and perhaps even beyond that. If I understand correctly, you can confirm that. Am I right?
Yeah, no, 100%. I sat at the desk that lobbyists from Google would call. You know, I would get a call from 9 Google lobbyists at, you know, on a big speaker call for them to try to lobby, you know, the U.S. government in order to basically coerce foreign countries in our upcoming negotiations. I mean, this was the bread and butter of you know, big government and big tech diplomacy.
That's kind of remarkable to me. I'm going to move forward with my thought in a second. But so you're saying that you would regularly receive, in your capacity as an employee of the State Department, calls from big tech, Google, and perhaps other companies in the tech space to influence the State Department to behave in a certain way.
Yes. Now they would pitch these as proposals. I mean, that's the way. But this is bread and butter State Department work. We simply call this stakeholder engagement. We say that U.S. commercial interests and companies are stakeholders, and we bring all the stakeholders to the table in representing the collective American people and collective American economy. You know, this was the Economic Bureau, and so you know that is a bilateral engagement. You know, the State Department reaches out to the private companies to get them on board with U.S. State Department initiatives, and the private companies engage the State Department to make sure their interests are represented, or to lobby for their interests to be represented in U.S. statecraft. There is a favors for favors relationship, and you know, this goes back a long time. I mean, this goes back to the 1800s. This practice, you know, the famous phrase about banana republics draws its name from the United Fruit Company, which set up basically puppet governments all over South and Latin America, basically under the protection of the U.S. State Department and the War Department. And you can make the argument that because of that interplay between big corporations and big government, that you know, 19th century Americans were able to have cheap access to sugar and agriculture. This, you know, as I mentioned, was the same thing in the big oil era. The issue is, though, is you never had a situation where the gas companies were cutting people off at the pump, you know, while they were working with big government to get favors from big government, that they were cutting off people, you know, from the pump when they went to pump their gas because of, you know, their cultural beliefs or their political beliefs. And so, you know, to me, I found it to be very inflammatory that the government was doing favors for technology companies while the technology companies appeared to be discriminating against U.S. citizens. And that was something that I thought was violative of the underpinning sort of ethical explanation for why this government and commercial nexus was even allowed.
Well, particularly because it's the citizenry in the United States that is represented in the government. The citizen, our citizenry is our government. But before we talk about that slippery slope, because it's so clear to me the way you just articulated how this good idea and this good intention of having representation and even influence over international business and other US-based interests, wasn't the United States at some point pre-tech influencing legacy media? Didn't they move over a little bit and they went from, I guess, let's say state-sponsored media, I don't know if that's the correct term of art, but what you described earlier, to then independent entities, perhaps like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Didn't that predate your experience, but maybe start to set the policy where it made sense for the government to get involved with private US-based businesses for influence and power?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's been this intertwining of legacy media and the foreign policy establishment really since the birth of you know, mass media in America. I mean, Citizen Kane is the story of the, you know, the Hearst Empire, which basically was the media outlet that's, you can say, started the Spanish-American War, which was the birth of the American Empire. You know, before 1898, we were just the American homeland. In 1898, when we won the Spanish-American War, we took Cuba from the Spanish and we took the Philippines from the Spanish and occupied it militarily for 45 years. And that's why we built up this, you know, super navy, was to, because we are now a world-spanning empire. So that, you know, that grew out of essentially a linkage between, you know, the Hearst and the Hearst folks and the War Department. And then you had the Office of War Information in 1942, and the Pentagon was what centralized what at that time had been all of our mass media properties in the U.S. The media, the print newspapers, early TV, early Hollywood, early radio, they were all rolled into this Office of War Information, which was the coordinating media wing of the Pentagon in order to create a whole society consensus around World War II and in order to fight fascism. It was basically, you know, and if you go back and look at these reels in the 1940s, you'll see virtually every U.S. media property rolled up in that and working with the Office of War Information. The big three American broadcast, you know, corporations, ABC, NBC, and CBS, which were the big three, you know, sort of news stations. Fox News didn't even come around until the 1990s. It was just those three, you know, options on TV every day for virtually the entirety of the 20th century. They were all started by Office of War Information veterans. You know, there's the famous example of, you know, what's known as Operation Mockingbird, which was a CIA program from the 1950s stretching through 1975 when it was basically revealed in the Church Committee hearings. This was a generation-long CIA legacy media program where the, you know, where Bill Colby, the CIA director, you know, confessed to having about 800 different media properties under the CIA's influence, including 10 to 12 rotating spots at the New York Times with the Sulzberger family. You had, in addition to that, you had something called Wisner's Wurlitzer, which was Frank Wisner, who was another one of these CIA godfather figures, you know, who bragged that he could play international media organizations like a Wurlitzer, you know, like a sort of long keyboard piano, and to in order to create global narratives because that were favorable to U.S. statecraft, because the CIA had penetrated the media organizations of virtually every country in NATO under the Marshall Plan, and then all over Asia through Radio Free Asia and throughout the world. Now, this was at the time the U.S. had a huge advantage in the information space in the 20th century before other countries developed their own robust internal media organizations. Because remember, you know, TV and radio were basically U.S., U.K., you know, dominated modalities for getting information across. And we had a first mover advantage there for about 30, 40 years. And so if Radio Free Europe piped in radio into a region, that was one of the, you know, only a handful of frequencies that citizens could even tune into. But, you know, and then this continued. You know, you can go into the CIA reading room and you can see CIA media task force memos in the early 1990s talking about the continuation of this relationship. You know, there was always this back door between mainstream media and the foreign policy establishment. And this is how legacy media retains a lot of access. For example, the New York Times was just invited by the Central Intelligence Agency onto these 12 military bases on the outer rim of Ukraine. This was not declassified information. You, a citizen journalist, can't just waltz your way into a top secret, highly classified, special compartmentalized information CIA base. This was something that the CIA reached out to the New York Times, invited them in, vetted them, put them through security so that the New York Times could publish a story that was favorable to the funding interests of the CIA. This is a backdoor relationship that's existed for the better part of a century now. And the issue is freedom on the internet threw a monkey wrench in that whole relationship, because these soft power proxies of the foreign policy establishment were now getting essentially outcompeted by citizen journalists on the internet.
So that's kind of interesting, and it's a great transition to speak about the fact that it seems like it would be natural. The United States government was so inexorably tied with legacy media that now when the internet came out, my understanding is it was born out of the United States government, but then eventually turned into social media. Like, of course, if you're sitting in the seat of the government and the blob, effectively, you would want to connect with Twitter and Facebook and Google and beyond, right? It seems very natural, again, if the intentions are right. So at what point did we see this? Like, we see a beginning of the structural transition where there's internet free speech and privatization going into perhaps the government coercing and impeding upon citizens' First Amendment rights. When did the blob start looking internal at effectively at the U.S. citizenry?
I would peg that at around 2014, and I'll sort of wind up the evolution to it. So just as you said, free speech on the internet was actually not so much a kind of First Amendment gung-ho support structure underpinning it. It was soft power projection. So when the Cold War ended in 1990, 1991, there was perceived to be a pressing need to be able to pipe U.S. media into this brave new world in a setting where a lot of countries responded to the soft power projection of the U.S. in the 20th century by creating their own state control over media. Their own newspapers in Egypt or in Iran or in Central and Eastern Europe or in Latin America. Their own radio stations, their own TV programming. And oftentimes, countries would close down their societies if they perceived that there might be foreign influence pumping up a dissident group to destabilize that country or to overthrow that country's government, which was a practice that the blob orchestrated something like 85 times in the 20th century on basically every continent except Antarctica. And so the internet in its early stages in 1991, was kind of a new Voice of America in the sense that, Voice America, as I mentioned, was part of this coterie of CIA proprietary media organizations at the time when there was very scant radio programming by other countries. And the internet was piped around the world partially as a way to be able to have U.S.-backed dissident groups have their own robust media ecosystems in places where there was state control over media. And this is one of the reasons that there was so much money flowing from the State Department, from DARPA, and from CIA NSA projects precisely for this effect. So remember, the internet itself started as a DARPA project in the 1960s. And in its first use case was taking social science data from the universities and digitizing it so that the U.S. military would be able to take all of this information that was being funded by universities to map foreign populations and foreign cultural issues and foreign political movements to create this sort of political heat map, because the U.S. at the time, it had grown into such a world-spanning empire that we began to have a problem with insurgency movements who were deposing U.S.-backed leaders in Vietnam, in Central and Eastern Europe, in Latin America. And so there was a ton of literature on these groups that had to be digitized. And this was one of the early use cases of the internet in the 1960s. This is why DARPA came under it was then called ARPA, but say DARPA, came under a huge amount of scrutiny by U.S., you know, basically anti-war protesters, and you know, predominantly liberal groups were vociferous in describing, you know, their opposition at Harvard University and at college campuses around the country, the octopus threat that the internet represented because of its role in U.S. imperialism, as it was described.
And that was pre-social media, right? That was just at a point where they were probably, if I understand correctly, collecting data and not even speaking to or at any person or individual, right? It was just a data collection.
Yeah, that was 40 years before.
Right.
That was in the 1960s. And right. If you want a good resource on this, there's a book called Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine, which goes through, you know, all the players in that story in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, fast forward to 1990, DARPA turns over control of the internet to the National Science Foundation. The National Science Foundation is basically the civilian arm of DARPA. You can think of it that way. Okay. Basically, it's technically a sort of civilian agency, but it's, you know, it does a lot of work adjacent to the military. It's basically this kind of dual use. You know, a lot of U.S. commercial products have these military origins, you know, not just the internet, but the cell phone does, you know, GPS tracking does. There's, you know, you can make an argument that much of the ingenuity of American technology is not so much originating in the commercial sector, but originating with military funding and subsidized by the U.S. military, and then sort of turned over to commercial stakeholders.
For sure.
And this is, you know, so, but, you know, what's really interesting is you mentioned, you know, how the government might have a role, or the foreign policy establishment might have a role in companies like Google. Well, Google is a fascinating, you know, case study because, you know, the World Wide Web comes out in 1991. Right away, we are piping it into foreign countries, and we are getting U.S.-backed dissident groups to start blogs, getting them to start static web pages, getting them to start web forums. We actually have USAID and State Department and National Endowment for Democracy funding to train dissident groups to use this early internet in order to establish their own media in a way that can't be shut down by the ruling government of that country. As this is happening, our intelligence services take a very active interest in how information is being diffused across the internet. So in 1995, DARPA created a program called the Massive Digital Data Systems Program, which was a DARPA program that was being spearheaded as a joint project of the CIA and the NSA. The NSA is basically the military's version of the CIA. And this was to track how birds of a feather flock together online in the early internet. Now, this is about a decade before social media, because, you know, Facebook was 2004, YouTube was 2005, Twitter was 2006, the smartphone was 2007. So right now we're in 1995. This was this DARPA program for tracking birds of a feather flocking together online. This DARPA grant program was actually how Sergey Brin and Larry Page launched Google. They were Stanford PhD students at the time in 1995. Their research was funded by this precise DARPA CIA NSA grant, and they basically, you know, used that grant funding to create the backbone architecture for Google. The very next year, 1996, they launched Google. The first year that Google went public, they became a military contractor. Google only has Google Maps because they bought the keyhole satellite technology from the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's wild.
You can thank the CIA for Google Maps. You know, they didn't make their... So, you know, there's long been this relationship of Google as being a Goliath of American statecraft. And you can make an argument that they were exporting the First Amendment in doing so from 1991 up until really only a few short years ago. So, you know, basically, as the story goes, you had this doctrine of digital statecraft, as it was called, in the State Department. This was pioneered by a guy named Jared Cohen, who was a guy in his early 20s who has recruited the State Department's policy planning staff, which is basically the division within state that coordinates the State Department and CIA. So as I mentioned, at state, you need to coordinate the overside of the iceberg and the underside of the iceberg so that the State Department knows what's going on in the country. If we're negotiating with the prime minister, we sort of have to know if the CIA is trying to overthrow the prime minister.
Sure.
You know, there's
sure.
a quarterback position there.
Right.
And it's this nexus at policy planning that does this. Now, Jared Cohen was a guy who had in his teens and early 20s, he had created something called movements.org. which and he had been embedded in a lot of these Middle East, North African dissident groups that were being sponsored by the U.S. State Department. And you know, as a very young guy in his mid-20s, he was surrounded by these older fuddy-duddies in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And you know, as the story goes, which is widely reported, he was basically the talk of town of Washington for an entire decade, as he later came to be effectively credited with starting the Arab Spring. Jared Cohen looked around and said, "Why are we running these operations out of U.S. embassies or consulates or CIA station houses? Everybody we want to recruit is on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube." This is in 2007, 2008. He was a Republican political appointee in the Condoleezza Rice State Department under George Bush. And this idea of using social media to put essentially color revolutions on steroids, to put, you know, regime change or destabilization efforts on steroids, because you no longer needed to, you know, run a black duffel bag of unmarked cash to a handful of, you know, sort of CIA liaisons, and then have that distributed to a dozen of their lieutenants, and have them distribute that to, you know, 100,000 different people in the trade union labor groups, or in the, you know, in all the different groups that are mobilized to create a revolution. You could just start a Twitter hashtag. You could just create a Facebook page. You could just, you know, sort of influence all of this via YouTube videos. And so this doctrine of digital statecraft was the talk of the town in the late stages of the Bush administration in 2007, 2008. Jared Cohen is a Republican political appointee. His work was considered so important that he was retained by Hillary Clinton when she became Secretary of State under President Obama's term. So this was a very bipartisan thing. And, you know, just a few short years later in 2011, the Arab Spring would kick off, where one by one, all the adversary governments of the Obama administration in the Middle East, North Africa, Tunisia, Egypt, several other countries had their governments toppled in Facebook and Twitter revolutions that were intermediated by these U.S. State Department funded NGOs. And so the issue is Jared Cohen took that special set of skills, and then his very next job after leaving the State Department in 2012 was to join Google and Google Jigsaw, which was, you know, said to be this one person think tank where Cohen was to stare at a white wall all day and think about all the ways that Google could solve complex geopolitical problems by using its proprietary data and resources. And the issue is the first thing Google Jigsaw did in late 2016, early 2017 was transition from free speech advocacy and how to use the internet to pipe free speech into countries that the foreign policy establishment was trying to establish a soft power toehold in, to internet censorship. And this is because of, you know, basically the geopolitical turbulence from 2014 through 2016 that made the foreign policy establishment focus less on the power of government to open up societies for speech, but to close them down to stop insurgency political movements and to close off the soft power projection of forces that they deem to be hostile.
So still working the technology and influence overseas, away from the American citizenry.
Well, that was the idea at first, but that facade fell through fairly quickly. So, you know, Jared Cohen's Jigsaw was came to be the progenitor of an artificial censorship technique. It's called natural language processing. This is a technique originally developed by the military to be able to detect the speech online of ISIS terrorist groups. You know, in 2014, 2015, the Obama administration put military boots on the ground in Syria. There was a big effort there to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad. And at the time, there was a big concern that ISIS recruiters were very active on Twitter and Facebook. And so the State Department created a censorship office called the Global Engagement Center, whose job was to interface with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Reddit and basically every speech discourse platform on the U.S. internet in order to stop ISIS propaganda on U.S. news feeds. And the way they did this was through an artificial intelligence technique that was pioneered by DARPA, that was, again, this NLP, natural language processing, which basically it looks at language. So it sense makes language on the internet to create narrative network maps. These, you may have seen some of these models or, visualizations of, you know, sort of like a sphere, and it'll have nodes and connection links between nodes. And you'll be able to say, okay, influencer X has messaging going out to these other influencers, and it forms this narrative is comprised of this big ball of yarn of these influencers. And here's what they're saying. And you can track different narratives that way. And what it does is it combines social science with computer science. So in order to create a narrative network map to mass censor or mass amplify in the hands of the foreign policy establishment, what you do is you hire a team of social scientists to map language. You say, okay, this is what this community talks about. Here's the unique set of phrases, of diction, of slang, of prefixes, of suffixes, of hashtags. Oftentimes, this will be accompanied by a multimedia database and the kind of memes, the kind of, you know, visual symbols that they use. And a complex database will be constructed that sort of looks almost sociologically or anthropologically at a particular political movement or cultural belief system to create this comprehensive, you know, heat map of what distinguishes them from other communities online, other birds of a feather. It's basically tracking the birds of a feather.
Sure, they're looking for keywords, right? They're looking for a specific. I remember you mentioned ISIS. I actually remember traveling internationally a lot during that time period. And ISIS was really all over social media, trying to recruit people from all over the world, from Europe, from North America, the United States included, posting just these horrific images and terrible messages. I would imagine at that point in time, Mike, like the United States government had the right intent, right? When they created this tool effectively where they were blending together social and empirical data, I think the intent there was in the right place. Do you agree?
Well, this is the thing. It's hard to argue against it, right? I mean, this is one of these things where you could argue it on moral and ethical grounds. You could argue it on national security grounds. You know, you could argue it on, I mean, there's, you know, it's the best laid, you know, best laid plans or best intentions. You can argue that the road to the underworld is paved with, you know, paved in gold. But, you know, this was something that was a technology that, again, you know, so you hire these teams of social scientists, and then you hire these computer scientists to basically take that lexicon, to take that linguistic roadmap, and then code in the de-boosters, the de-amplifiers, the various, you know, sort of remove, reduce, inform censorship interventions in order to stop the virality of that kind of content online. The issue is it was so effective that it was almost like one of these, you know, we can almost compare it to like the, you know, the ring in Lord of the Rings or something. It's one of these things that's it's such a power that, you know, perhaps no person should be able to wield it. It maybe won't be something that, you know, needs to be cast in the fire because it's so powerful that you can't, it's hard to imagine people refusing that power in order to wield it against their own domestic adversaries. And this is really something that I became very mortified by personally when I came across this in late 2016, because the very first thing that Google Jigsaw did, again, Google Jigsaw, run by, you know, the guy who created this doctrine of digital statecraft to be able to overthrow foreign governments, you know, to be able to destabilize foreign societies, to be able to use social media in the process, that you know, the first three things that Google Jigsaw trained their weapons of mass deletion on, these AI natural language processing techniques on, were on political matters. You know, they were on things around the 2016 election, things around you know, the sort of Brexit movement in UK and things around you know, other cultural issues in the energy space. And so
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just in plain English for the audience, can you explain exactly like how it worked? Like, give an example. Is it a person going to Google to search something specific and the results just don't populate? Or is it a situation where a person is trying to send out a message across social media back then and it was not able to reach anyone? Like, in plain English, at this point in time, I don't want to fast forward, but I think we're at about 2016 right now, if I'm correct. And in that moment in time, what was it that if you were a consumer or just a United States citizen, like, what was happening?
So this is late 2016, early 2017, and this product that Google Jigsaw put out, and again, Google Jigsaw was effectively a CIA branch at that point. It was run by the guy who left the coordinating wing of the CIA and State Department to run a nonprofit incubator within Google that was being used, you know, for, you know, the Arab Spring and other, you know, sort of U.S. State Department high priority conflict zone areas. And so, you know, what Google Jigsaw produced in late 2016, early 2017 was a commercial retail project, a product called Perspective AI. Now, what Perspective AI did was you could plug in any sentence. You could go onto, you know, Jigsaw's website, and if you wanted to test this out before your social media platform onboarded it, you could go into Perspective AI and you can type any sentence in the world. You know, Mark is a silly person who loves tennis. Randomly, I'm just, and that will, and what it would do is it would spit out a score of that sentence. It would, now they would call these toxicity scores, and toxicity was said to take into account, you know, 15 to 16 different metrics about how much of that speech was assessed as hate speech, how much of it was assessed as, you know, a call to violence, how much of it was assessed to be, you know, borderline content about a conspiracy theory, you know, that was mapped in a separate database about how dangerous that was to society or whatnot. So there would be a comprehensive score and it would spit it out. So it might say, if our sentence is Mark is a silly person, you know, who enjoys tennis, you know, it will literally spit out a numerical number that will say, you know, 0.11. And that would represent a toxicity score of, you know, 11%. It's a score between, you know, 0 and 1, or, you know, 0 to 100%, essentially. And that would say that, you know, that is an 11% toxic statement, because I said the word silly. Silly might be a sort of low grade pejorative statement that might be viewed as targeted abuse and harassment if you were to go too far into that, but it's modified by the fact that it's a sort of low severity word, and it's in the context of talking about tennis, which is a relatively innocuous topic. But if you were to talk about highly sensitive political matters, or if you were to use speech that was being codified by the social science researchers as being, you know, highly inflammatory, you know, at the time, you know, immigration was a very big issue at the time, because NATO was highly concerned, and the CIA and the State Department, the Pentagon were highly concerned that the rules-based international order was going to come apart in 2016 because of the rise of these populist movements. You know, there's the Brexit in the UK. They were afraid that Frexit was going to happen in France. So France was going to leave the European Union. Spexit was going to happen in Spain because of the Vox party there. Grexit was going to happen in Germany because of AfD. You know, Italexit was going to happen because of Matteo Salvini. Grexit was going to happen in Greece. So the EU would come undone, which would mean NATO would come undone, which would mean there'd be no enforcement arm for the international creditor class and the IMF and the World Bank. So there was a five alarm fire at the time that all of these institutions said to be protecting democracy set up in the 1940s would become defunct and toothless if free speech on the internet was not contained. And Google Jigsaw's Perspective AI was really the first in a now billion-dollar industry around AI censorship technology development, much of which is funded by the U.S. government today. You know, and so again, this would manifest itself in the same way that chess computers work. This is actually how I entered this space. I was an avid chess player as a kid. I competed all over the country. It was just a part-time pastime that I loved. And I came of age at the time when chess computers overtook chess humans. And I had remembered hearing, you know, that this was never going to happen, but it was very obvious as a child that it would. And the way you train with chess computers is very similar to the way Google Jigsaw's Perspective AI works. It assesses a move. It does brute force calculation of a billion moves per second in terms of its analysis, just algebra. As these AI censorship weapons. Yeah, we'll analyze a billion different, you know, sort of keywords and sentiment analysis modifiers and all this training data that goes into creating these models. And it spits out a number. You know, a chess computer will say -0.7, which it'll assess as being black. If you play this move, you'll be winning as playing the black pieces by 0.7. This is an unstoppable functionality, you know, versus the human mind in the chess world. And this is what we ran into in the censorship industry with these retail AI censorship tools. It would be able to say the development of this is very much like the development of nuclear weapons. You know, it didn't stop after we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we went on to create more and more powerful bombs, hydrogen bombs. And this testing went on for 15 years. And we're now living in this age of this kind of foreign policy establishment, private sector sort of cutout development of the ability to censor speech online. And this is something that goes way beyond partisan, you know, the natural push and pull of partisan disagreement. You don't want any government to have this power. It's because it's a really a God button.
But Mike, when you talk, just going back to prospective AI and the way it was trained, I think it's a problem in also, it seems like it was trained from a centralized viewpoint, right? The data that was, the standards that were built to create that toxicity score were created, if I understand correctly, and this is a question, they were created by both the United States government and Google. So it was a very subjective scoring system based upon what those participants decided would be toxic. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And this is part of the problem with, you know, creating this power is somebody, you know, whoever gets to decide, you know, what goes into it, decides what comes out of it. And, you know, as I mentioned at the time, you know, there were things like hate speech codified into the toxicity scores. Well, at the time, you know, NATO was hugely concerned about the rise of these populist movements in Europe, who were rising because of, you know, in large part because, you know, after the assassination of Gaddafi in Libya, there was a large influx of immigrants into Europe, and there was a sort of political response by European parties there, and. You know, so for example, anti-immigration rhetoric, which prior to, you know, 2013 was considered an ordinary push and pull. You know, some people wanted more immigration, some people wanted less. There was a natural sort of internal political debate in every society about what level of immigration they wanted. These things were being hard-coded into Google Jigsaw as being hate speech. Now, hate speech is a highly subjective thing. You know, there's obvious examples of it that anybody can sort of, you know, sort of see, you know, it's sort of like the pornography, I think is, I don't know if it was, you know, which Supreme Court justice, you know, said, back in the 20th century, I know it when I see it, you know, there's a lot of gray area there. And if you can essentially rig the debate in a country by having this God button, the ability to instantly kill any speech on the internet over Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Reddit, Discord, Twitch, you name it, instantly be throttled because of the AI, because that's hard-coded any sentiment analysis that opposes a certain policy view as being, you know, over that toxicity threshold. So, and the way perspective worked is it would have these confidence thresholds where different censorship interventions would be triggered at different confidence intervals. So I mentioned with that sentence, if Marcus Cillian plays tennis is an 11% toxicity score, that would not make it onto the heat map of the trust and safety teams. You know, they would set it at something like 85%. If perspective detects a comment in a reply section or a tweet or a Facebook post or a speech to text transliteration of a YouTube video as being above the 85% threshold, then it would automatically be put in a sort of purgatory zone where the speech would persist on the platform, but it would not be visible. It would be essentially shadow banned. Well, if it was above a sort of 95%, then it might be automatically, you know, suspended and then put in a sort of, you know, review queue for the Mechanical Turks, you know, hired by the social media companies to just click through posts and determine whether they live or die. But this is something that, you know, basically puts the power in the hands of these largely government funded and government coordinated outside institutions who program that AI.
So you mentioned NATO and I guess the United States perhaps influencing NATO to a certain extent to move the installation effectively of new governments. Is that what was happening? How is NATO using, I guess, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and social media to impact the political landscape in, you know, throughout Europe?
Yeah, and also just let me also make clear that this, you know, again, this is not a political issue. NATO also targeted Jeremy Corbyn, the, you know, left-wing Labour Party leader in the UK because of Jeremy Corbyn's foreign policy positions against NATO, which were very similar to 2016 Bernie Sanders. You know, the blob targeted Bernie Sanders in the same way that they targeted sort of, you know, right-wing populists, because Bernie Sanders wanted to limit U.S. foreign interventionism debate to pay for free universal health care and free college tuition. And so this is, it's, you know, this is way far above the level of left, right, you know, Democrat, Republican, yada, yada. But you know, what NATO started to do in 2014, which this sort of gets us to the deep origins of the censorship industry, you know, free speech on the internet was considered an unalloyed good. It was getting State Department funding. It was getting CIA, NSA funding. It was getting Pentagon funding for free speech technology. You know, all of the internet anonymity tools that we now know and love, like VPNs, virtual private networks to hide your IP address, and end-to-end encrypted chat, and Tor, the dark web. You know, these were all DARPA, you know, DARPA-sponsored R&D projects, and then were rolled out commercially in the same way that the internet itself was, in the same way GPS was, in the same way cell phone technology was. And so, you know, this was because the foreign policy establishment loved free speech on the internet so much, because it was so effective at causing Arab Spring type events, you know, with these internet revolutions. The issue is in 2014, you know, and this gets us to some of the sensitive issues, you know, currently playing out around Ukraine. And I know that there's a lot of, you know, reasonable disagreement, I think, on both sides of that. So without sort of getting too deep into the nuances of it, what happened was, is in the run-up to the 2014 was kind of the seismic geopolitical event that set the stage for what happened in 2022 with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and a lot of the conflict between the Trump administration and you know, the foreign policy establishment in Washington around Russia policy and around you know, reorienting U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Ukraine and Russia. In 2014, there was an overthrow of a democratically elected government there. There was a president named Viktor Yanukovych. He was a guy who was stuck between the East and the West. He had signed a lot of commercial agreements with U.S. energy companies between 2011 and 2013. But at the same time, Ukraine was half Russian. You know, you had this Western half, and then you had this Eastern ethnic half. And it was split basically down the middle, 50-50, East-West, NATO-Russia. So Yanukovych was a guy who was basically torn between both worlds. He had been trying to cut these commercial deals with the East while having these sort of security arrangements, I'm sorry, commercial deals with the West, with these security arrangements and political affiliations with the East. And you know, in early 2014, that government was overthrown immediately after Yanukovych refused an IMF proposed trade deal, and Yanukovych sided with essentially the Russians with the trade deal there. At that point, there was a mob, a sort of January 6th style parliament building raid in the Euromaidan Square there, where tens of thousands of essentially, you know, right-wing paramilitary insurgents surrounded the parliament building, ran Yanukovych out of office. And, you know, these groups were funded to the tune of $5 billion by the U.S. State Department. Victoria Nuland, who was the head of the Ukraine embassy there, was personally handing out water bottles and cookies to these, you know, rioters as they were doing this. This was, you know, and immediately afterwards, Victoria Nuland and Jeff Pyatt, another, you know, major State Department official, were caught on hot mic planning the next installed president of the government of Ukraine. But the issue was immediately after that, there was a sort of counter coup. The entire eastern part of Ukraine broke off at that point, declared itself independent, not subject to the new Kiev government. Crimea held a formal referendum to join the Russian Federation. This was something that the State Department and the foreign policy establishment were not anticipating. There had never been this kind of forceful pushback to such a high-level strategic initiative by NATO during the 20th century. It was backstopped by the Russian military, which made it very difficult for there to be a formal entry of NATO to retake that territory in the East, because it would involve potentially World War III. And the issue was despite $5 billion of U.S. State Department funding of media organizations and soft power projection mechanisms, it still was not enough to sway hearts and minds in Eastern Europe and in Crimea. And so at that point, NATO declared essentially a military media doctrine The time was called the Gerasimov Doctrine because of they said Valery Gerasimov, this Russian general, was waging military war through control over media and hearts and minds in eastern Ukraine. Then that name changed to something called hybrid warfare, which is this idea that NATO needs to no longer see war as being a kinetic affair. It's mostly a political and media affair. And this gave rise to a NATO doctrine called From Tanks to Tweets. And you can look this up. You know, Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, who did this world tour, you know, announcing the From Tanks to Tweets doctrine, which was this idea that NATO was moving from a focus on tanks to a focus on tweets. And they set up this infrastructure in 2014, these formal NATO media control branches called centers of excellence. And they were centers of excellence over strategic communications, meaning over media communications, primarily in the social media space. And so you had this newly built NATO capacity. They set these up all over Central and Eastern Europe. So they set them up in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, all the way into Germany. This was this same sort of Central Eastern Europe region that was the focus of the Cold War. You know, the biggest Cold War battles raged over Germany from the 1940s to the 1990s. Germany is the industrial base of the European Union. It's also one of the major import paths of Russian gas through the Nord Stream pipelines, which connected to Germany and which bypassed Ukraine. But essentially, in 2014, NATO began to say, you know what? This free speech thing was great while it lasted, and we're still going to be highly active in the free speech space, but we need an ability to kill Russian propaganda from being able to penetrate hearts and minds in Central and Eastern Europe after this Crimea disaster and after this breakaway, this civil war raging in Ukraine. And so under the moniker of stopping Russian propaganda, a censorship capacity was built by NATO. But then Brexit happened 2 years later in June 2016, and the foreign policy establishment that Brexit only happened because of Russian influence on social media in the United Kingdom. So now the NATO hybrid warfare went from Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Germany, stretching all the way to Western Europe. They made the same argument that Marine Le Pen's movement in France was being backed by the Russians, because Marine Le Pen was also running on a policy of cheap Russian gas as opposed to more expensive U.S. LNG. And then they made the argument, of course, that the 2016 election was essentially a Russian propaganda exercise. There was a formal CIA memo on January 6, 2017, saying that. There was an FBI special investigation. This was ratified by 17 different intelligence agencies. So now you had this hybrid warfare doctrine, this military control over social media, not just being some foreign-facing, esoteric fringe activity on the edge of the Baltics, but now it was stretching all the way across NATO. And this is where you started to have the Pentagon, the State Department, and the intelligence services penetrate every aspect of domestic speech online starting in 2016.
So how much influence did the United States have when NATO transformed into this tanks and did you call it tanks and tweets doctrine?
From tanks to tweets.
From tanks to tweets. I mean, at that point, I would imagine, Mike, that the United States played a major role, given the fact that we're financing NATO to such an extent, major role with regards to influencing the policy and then helping to execute on that policy too. Is that fair to assume?
Yeah, we led the charge, us in the UK. London figures very heavily in this, actually, as much as the US. The US foreign policy establishment, the State Department, Defense Department, CIA axis is, the blob extends to London, if you will. We call it the Transatlantic Alliance. It's the Transatlantic National Security State. So if you will, just as whenever you see the State Department, you should always think the interagency. You should always think whenever you see the State Department, the Pentagon is involved and the CIA is involved and you just don't see it yet. Whenever the Pentagon is involved, the State Department and the CIA are involved and you just don't see it yet. Whenever the CIA is involved, the State Department and the Pentagon are involved. They always move together. So too it is with US and UK statecraft. And this has been a tradition that stretches back to World War II. So whenever you see the Pentagon involved, you're going to see the British Ministry of Defense. Whenever you see the State Department involved, that means there's been some sort of transatlantic coordination with the UK Foreign Office. And so too it is with the Central Intelligence Agency and institutions like MI5 and MI6. And this is partially because when the Brits lost their formal empire in the 1940s and 1950s, you can make the argument that this transition from military empire building to soft power empire building hit the British Empire far, far harder than it hit any other European empire. There's a French Empire in Africa. There's the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Italians. Everyone had properties, in the run up to World War II all over the world. But the British Empire was probably the largest, and it sort of formally collapsed with the Suez Crisis in 1957. The Brits had to move very hard into becoming a financial empire through their offshore banking syndicates, and a soft power projection empire, through British statecraft and British intelligence, in order to maintain an approximated version of the empire that they had in the 20th century. And much of that involved, for example, the oil and gas space. So in the Ukraine story, for example, Victoria Nuland, as she was making this speech about the $5 billion that they'd pumped into Ukrainian civil society in the run-up to the 2014 overthrow of that government, right behind her were signs for Chevron and ExxonMobil. This was because Chevron had signed a $10 billion agreement with Ukraine's Naftogaz, their publicly held state gas company. So did Shell, the London-based, this is Royal Dutch Shell, but it's now just called Shell because it's primarily the UK rather than, the UK Dutch enterprise. And Shell had signed a $10 billion agreement to mine the shale reserves in eastern Ukraine. So you had tens of billions of dollars, Chevron, Shell, Halliburton, which is, famously this Dick Cheney was both CEO and chairman of the board of Halliburton. Halliburton signed the agreement from 2011 to 2013 for the oil and gas processing rights, both in the Crimea Black Sea region and in the Donbass, east of the Dnieper River shale reserves there. So you had in the aggregate about $50 billion of US, UK oil and gas interests in the precise region that had just been militarily overtaken by the Russians in the 2014 counter coup. And so you had this deep relationship between oil intelligence, between US and UK statecraft in order to, to their deep relationship with the military. These are part of the drivers of that story, but you can now understand why it is that NATO took such a vested interest in stopping the rise of political movements who wanted neutrality with Russia, because that would, if the game were to end then in the sort of post 2014 milieu where you now had all of these resources under Russian military occupation, well, that now screws up $50 million in present investments by some of the largest stakeholders at the U.S. statecraft and intelligence. And that's leaving aside the agricultural interests and a lot of other long range plans around defanging the Russian military, because the only reason that the Obama administration was not able to continue the war in Syria, for example, was because Russia provided Syria with these S-400 air defense systems, which they could only produce in terms of their war machine because of their energy exports to Europe. So if you could carve those off, there's a whole hodgepodge of stakeholder interests in doing this. But present politics and culture is really mediated through this kind of proxy war playing out, several miles above its head.
So, I mean, it's fair to think then, even if you fast forward to today, we're still seeing these geopolitical macro concepts across the globe, right? Struggle for power surrounding energy, struggle for power surrounding financial systems. And a lot of that is fueled by controlling the narrative, by controlling the media and the information that's reaching the citizens, and frankly, the information that's not reaching the citizens too.
Oh, absolutely. And this is where, again, it starts to get troubling from a civilian standpoint and from a human rights standpoint, which is it is now, no matter who you are, no matter what party, no matter what your belief system, you're confronted with this ethical issue. This use of social media as an instrument of statecraft, this control over speech by a foreign policy establishment deputized with the Department of Dirty Tricks power, formally, You know, the Central Intelligence Agency operates under National Security Council Memo 10-2, which says that it can engage in criminal activity. It can overthrow governments. It can control media as long as it's plausibly deniable. You know, once these agencies are imbued with this power over speech and it becomes embedded and mature, the entire administration and ebb and flow of elections comes under its heel. So I'll give you a great example here. Is the State Department now gets readouts of all the social media activity of elections around the world, or, you know, basically hot button. You know, if you're in the State Department, you will get SBU emails, you know, sensitive but unclassified emails around the social media activity, you know, the YouTube popularity of different groups that are US State Department funded. The State Department will work with all the social media companies in every election around the world. So this is another thing, right? We talked about how the blob might be a good thing in a lot of ways, right? That it's, you know, I criticize it on human rights grounds, but you can make an argument that we would not have American prosperity unless we had this bully pulpit to be able to manipulate foreign governments to profit, you know, American citizens at a number of levels. But you have to understand there's a regional desk for every country on this planet, okay? Whether that's Middle East, North Africa, whether that's CEE, Central and Eastern Europe, you know, whether that's Sub-Saharan Africa, whether that's Western Hemisphere for Latin America, you know, whether that's, you know, Central Asia, Southeast Asia, there is a regional desk for every country on the globe. And on every country in the globe, the State Department has a preferred set of winners and losers in every election, because every country's government, you know, this is something that's important. You know, I say a lot, but not so much publicly, but it's a useful concept. I like to say there's no such thing as domestic policy, because every country's domestic policy is another country's foreign policy. What the Philippines decides to do domestically in terms of who wins or loses an election in the Philippines is going to influence U.S. power projection all over the Pacific Rim. You know, who wins an election in Australia is going to impact what we can do with military bases there, what we can do with soft power projection in the South China Sea. Who wins an election in Tanzania is going to determine whether we have access to the copper and the aluminum and the titanium and the oil and gas in Tanzania. Different parties. Now, countries tend by default to be nationalistic. They tend to want what's best for their own people. And when there is foreign exploitation, foreign extraction of their natural resources, foreign control over their ports and dams, foreign military bases on that soil, foreign NGOs who are eclipsing domestic organizations in terms of their power over domestic affairs, people tend to resent that, and political movements will form to oppose that, and those will manifest itself in a State Department heat map of opposition to U.S. interests. Given that every country's election has a preferred set of winners and losers by the State Department, and the State Department's job, how you get promoted in the State Department, how you get profitable sinecures at think tanks afterwards, or board of executive spots at commercial companies who depend on the State Department to protect them, depends on how well you do in that region in terms of manipulating that country's elections. The State Department is now inextricably interwoven in the regional desks of Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Twitch and Discord and all of the regional affairs that happen in Tanzania or Congo or Venezuela or Brazil or, you know, Vietnam or, you know, Australia or, I mean, you name it, is Ukraine. The State Department intermediates with that now to be able to put its thumb in every election on that. This is why the State Department and the National Endowment for Democracy, it should be very troubling, for example. The National Endowment for Democracy is the CIA's premier cutout organization. There's tens of thousands of NGOs that are government-organized, non-governmental organizations between the State Department, USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, the Defense Department, you name it. We have dozens, and just congressional mandates, U.S. Institute for Peace. The National Endowment for Democracy is a very famous one. Even the Washington Post in the early 1990s, described it as a CIA cutout set up to do overtly what the CIA was getting in trouble for doing covertly, using a democracy predicate rather than a cloak and dagger formal overthrow. If we want to overthrow a country's government, but we don't want to be said to be doing that as a matter of U.S. policy, we just want to happen independently. What we do is we capacity build a network of NGOs and civil society institutions and activist groups, and that money is intermediated through groups like the National Endowment for Democracy. Well, the National Endowment for Democracy has a social media censorship program in something like 120 countries now. Now, they will call this a counter disinformation program, but it's not counter disinformation through counter speech. It's counter disinformation by labeling domestic political activity in 120 countries as being disinformation. And they can do this through a number of ways. They can say, well, the Russians want this group to win in Tanzania, or the Chinese want this group to win in Congo, or the Venezuelans want this
in the United States' best interest.
They can use that predicate. They can use a hate speech predicate. Oh, this group in Venezuela is, they did this in Myanmar, for example. This group is being as hateful towards the Rohingya. But behind that are the commercial interests of the Chamber of Commerce, of the oil and gas companies in the region who don't want that company to win because they're running on nationalizing, the oil reserves there or the copper mines. And so, this doublespeak that our intelligence agencies are deputized to do because they have a formal plausible deniability doctrine. They have a legal obligation to lie. These are the same institutions intermediating our diplomacy in the region and are the ones who are, the ones who are tasked with producing disinformation are the ones who miraculously are tasked with determining disinformation and censoring disinformation, which coincidentally, happens to be able to put its thumb on the press on every election around the world. If this, we're in the adolescent stage of this, if this is allowed to full maturity, you're never going to be able to have a domestic election in any country, around the globe, because you're going to run headlong into a statecraft operation if you simply want to vote for a party that you agree with.
So, Mike, are you balancing, like, looking into the future in your mind? Are you balancing, because there are benefits to the way that the United States government is effectively coercing and influencing the economic landscape, the political landscape, and different cultural issues on a global scale? Are you looking at that and balancing it versus the chilling impact it will have ultimately here domestically in the United States? And you're saying, we don't see that far out. It's ultimately the benefit that we've been getting for, all of these decades by, pushing our influence across the globe through legacy media, through current new tech media. It's not going to outweigh the negative impact of what's in front of us. And if you see it as the negative impact is greater than the benefit, what is that negative impact exactly?
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you bring this up, actually. I mean, this is a big part of what I do, because the first level is bringing awareness to this issue and trying to stop the excesses of government overreach in the space. And then a lot of times, when I do these lectures or I present this evidence or I make this case, the response is a lot of pitchforks. Oh yeah, tear the whole thing down. God, this is really, really evil. And I totally understand that impulse. But the next step is to sort of temper that to say, well, listen, this may require scalpel work, because this is a very complex story that gets at the heart of American power and gets at the heart of American economic prosperity. There's a complex interplay here between the security issues and the human rights issues and the free speech issues. And so, a lot of my focus is on translating this in a way that can preserve certain essential government functions, but removing, this sort of excess power to be able to, do things domestically that are frankly human rights abuses that I can't imagine anybody, no matter what their belief system is, wants to have as a permanent, federal government power or a foreign policy establishment power, because that basically puts our foreign facing Department of Dirty Tricks in charge of all civilian domestic affairs.
It's really interesting also when you think in terms of, like, from a tech perspective, Mike, the concept of centralization versus decentralization. It reminds me of conversations I had with engineers and coders in China like 5-6 years ago that were really bullish on blockchain technology. And a few of them actually said to me, I never thought about it this way. I take maybe here in America, I take it for granted as, you know, as a New Yorker. But they said, I now have freedom because of blockchain. And they were really talking about the underlying decentralized ability to transfer information, data, but they were talking about entertainment. They literally said, like, we could get Netflix movies now, or we could create something and sell it and be paid however we want with cryptocurrency. And I wonder to a certain extent if what you're talking about is also going to have a, it will serve as an impetus to much more of a decentralized approach to the transfer of information, the transfer of currency between individuals, between entities, and expanding on a Web3 blockchain ecosystem. I think it's going to be important, especially in, like, you know, this day and age of cancel culture, where all of a sudden you're seeing, I mean, we could talk about this all day long, but you've seen, you know, big tech retailers shut down, you know, political figures that they don't like. We've seen, or even full on social media, right? With Parler, for example, wasn't Parler shut down to a certain extent because they were using third party cloud services. So I think that it's a real interesting place that we're in. Just to bring it back to America, I know, I appreciate you've been with us for so long. I just have another question. So right now we have Murthy versus Missouri in the Supreme Court. And the issue is, like, whether or not the United States coercively censored Americans vis-a-vis social media. So how much censorship have we experienced here in the United States, in your opinion, as a result of the government kind of leveraging social media to control the narrative and control the messaging?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't even know that the crux issue of the case is whether the government coerced so much as whether it's a good thing, whether they should be allowed to do so. I mean, it's actually kind of amazing, you know, the goalpost moving that that the federal government's lawyers have made there. They've argued formally that the First Amendment's classical interpretation, you know, has to be essentially discarded because the First Amendment didn't contemplate the implications of social media. And, you know, in terms of, you know, there are things about that case that are obviously coercive. You know, when the FBI, you know, tells a company to take something down, when you know, DHS uses these cutouts to be able to use threatened government pressure. If they don't censor this, then the State Department is not going to lobby on your behalf against the European Digital Services Act, or there will be an antitrust investigation out of the Senate Intelligence Committee or out of the Banking Committee with the Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar threats. These were all things that were conveyed. This forms the guts of the case in the statement of facts. But then there are the sort of there are gradations of coercion, which I think is really where the scalpel will be taken by the justices in terms of how far they go. But, you know, I mean, the way the censorship industry works is it takes four categories of institutions in what they call a whole society model. Now, they call it the whole society counter misinformation, counter disinformation, counter malinformation model. Malinformation, you know, misinformation is said to be, you know, it's false, but you didn't know it was false. Disinformation is it was a lie and you knew it ahead of time, so it's deceptive. And then malinformation is, well, it's true, but it's still misleading in the aggregate. It's factually true or factually non-falsifiable, but it leads people to a misleading overall conclusion where it undermines public faith and confidence in a critical, you know, U.S. government initiative. And so these are the three sort of categories there: mis, dis, and malinformation. And in 2017, the U.S. government began constructing what it called a whole of society model for, and I'm just going to call it the whole society censorship network, because calling it counter mis, dis, and malinformation is very disingenuous. It's not counter speech. It's about taking speech down in one of three forms. They call it remove, reduce, inform. Remove is just, you know, banning it, suspending it, deleting it. Inform is like affixing a fact check label, and reduce is that huge array of friction techniques, throttling its virality, putting it in a purgatory state, making it not searchable, making it not recommendable, yada yada. So, you know, so it's this whole of society censorship network that was constructed deliberately within the U.S. government by the U.S. government, which connects four different categories of institutions. The first is government agencies. and I'll get into the specifics of this, but the government agencies, you think of it like a four-part quadrant: government agencies, private sector companies, civil society institutions, and media allies. Okay, so those four, you've got on the government side, this all started, you know, technically you can argue it started with the State Department's Global Engagement Center in 2014. This was the original sort of toehold, but then the basically the folks who constructed this decided there need to be a domestic facing one version of the State Department's Global Engagement Center, because the State Department is banned by law from censoring domestic tweets, you know, without some national security predicate like ISIS. So the very first one that was constructed was a censorship agency within DHS called CISA. Now, it's a long name, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, but it has nothing to do with security. Okay, it was a cyber censorship office, because they argued, you know, their job was to protect critical infrastructure in the cyber realm. And then they declared elections to be critical infrastructure. And then they declared tweets to be a cyber attack on critical infrastructure if it contained mis-dis or malinformation. So, you know, the analogy that I, you know, that I gave on the Tucker, you know, hit and in the Russell Brand, and, you know, that just, I think it's a useful thing to keep in mind, is you could literally be on a toilet seat at 9:30 on a Thursday night and say, you know, actually, I don't like the result of this election. And you would be triggering, you know, if they're, you know, in 2020, they had this thing about delegitimization. Anyone who delegitimized election processes, results, or outcomes, you know, was said to be attacking, undermining critical infrastructure. And so, you know, you could be on a toilet seat saying, I disagree with the use of mail-in ballots. And now you're caught up in a DHS cyber censorship web where they're saying you are carrying out a cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure by undermining public faith and confidence in the use of mail-in ballots. They did the same thing for COVID-19. You know, DHS's CISA office put out a formal YouTube video, a 6-minute YouTube video, instructing young children to report their own relatives, their own family members for disinformation if they cited CDC data around the fatality rates of COVID-19. They put this out in 2021. They had a young girl named Susan reporting her Uncle Steve. They walked her through how to do it. You click the report to Facebook for disinformation, because Uncle Steve in the video was citing CDC data to argue that COVID was no more fatal than the flu. They call that malinformation, even though it was CDC data, and even though it was factually true information that the vitality rate was the same. It undermined public faith and confidence in the severity of the COVID narrative. This was being produced by the Cybersecurity Office of DHS. From DHS, it spawned out into what they called the whole of government, which was this idea that once they believed they had a legal mandate to be able to censor domestic speech, every other government agency felt that it had a sort of predicate to do so. So the FBI on the pressure side, the National Science Foundation on funding censorship mercenary firms, the State Department, the Pentagon, it was a whole of government, you know, every government agency involved in the national security space would lend its own proprietary resources to this whole society censorship network. On the private sector, you know, so that's the first box is government. The second one is private sector. These are the social media platforms. So this meant all of those government agencies would interface with Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and Discord and Reddit and Twitch and everyone. It also meant the private sector censorship mercenary firms. These are firms like Google Jigsaw or Logically AI or NewsGuard. This is the pop-up industry of private sector companies whose professional products and services are artificial intelligence scan and ban products or censorship services that they are hired by the platforms, you know, to do in order to basically do favors for the federal government. So the federal government will do favors for them internationally, you know, as I mentioned, which was my former job to do on their behalf. On the civil society side, these are NGOs, university centers, nonprofits, and community activist groups who work together with the federal government and who work together with the tech platforms as that third stool. So there are over 60 universities currently who receive federal funding just from the National Science Foundation, in addition to State Department grants and Defense Department grants, for countering mis-dis and malinformation, for censoring. And again, this is not counter speech. So for example, you know, the University of Michigan got a $5.5 million grant to create a dynamic digital dashboard for media institutions to have a heat map of people who are discrediting media online, because media is deemed by the National Science Foundation to be a democratic institution. So if you discredit legacy media, you are carrying out an attack on democracy. the federal government is saying, well, it's our job to defend democracy. And so they're, so again, this is a laundering apparatus, because that fourth quadrant is media and fact-checking organizations. All of the major media fact-checking organizations are government subsidized. Poynter Institute, for example, is the big umbrella one that all of the major fact-checking groups are folded under. Well, Poynter Institute is something like 18 different State Department grants alone, in addition to working with the National Endowment for Democracy and other CIA cutouts. But here, just in that one example of course correct, again, there's hundreds of millions of dollars of these grants. So it's a government-subsidized industry. You have the federal government through the National Science Foundation paying a civil society organization, the University of Michigan, to create a censorship heat map for media organizations, so the media organizations can flag it to the social media companies. You know, and these sorts of things happen all over the place. You know, media literacy is a government initiative that pumps funding into tech companies for censoring things that are deemed to make users media illiterate. I mean, there's the industry itself is so government subsidized. I'll give you just one example. I know I've been going on for some time here. But as early as 2020, when I was sitting in the State Department, I remember reading a lobbying letter. Now, this is before all of the recent pressure against the federal government on censorship issues. This is at the time there was a lot of talk about Section 230, which is this, you know, it's the Communications Decency Act. It's what allows the safe harbor for social media platforms to not be sued. So, you know, there was a lot of talk at the time by free speech activists about repealing Section 230 or enforcing Section 230 to treat social media companies who censor First Amendment speech as a publisher rather than as a platform, and that would kill their safe harbor. I remember reading a lobbying letter at the time which argued that there were over 100,000 U.S. jobs that were dependent on content moderation, and if Section 230 reform went through, it would be akin to shutting down a coal mine in West Virginia, because so many Americans would lose their jobs if you got rid of internet censorship. That was in 2020. That was 4 years ago.
That's mind-blowing, actually.
Yeah, well, but they're not entirely wrong. I mean, there's probably 200,000 or 300,000 U.S. jobs in that space now. There's probably going to be 1 million jobs in the next couple of years because of these new state law mandates. California, New York, Illinois, Rhode Island have all passed mandatory media literacy laws, which are going to create hundreds of thousands of professional censorship jobs as a matter of state law. So this is going to be, there's going to be millions of people potentially on U.S. payroll depending on the censorship industry. If it's not stopped now, you know, it is going to do economic damage later.
Mike, can you put a market valuation on Censorship Inc.?
Well, the content moderation, trade publications, I think in 2022 pegged it at $8 billion worldwide.
Wow.
Content moderation. That was 2 years ago. I'd say it's probably doubled in that time.
Wow.
It's a massive industry, yeah, because everyone's got a stake in it. Every company has a stake in the flow of information for their own reputation and for government initiatives that protect their investments. You know, every major company is a multinational company now, which means they need the State Department to influence elections on their behalf in 180 some countries around the world. The civil society institutions are dependent on the money in order to get the universities funded, in order to have the NGOs funded. The media institutions are dependent on the government money, because that is what protects them against competition from alternative media. And that is what protects their monopoly in terms of Google search results or in Facebook news feeds. You know, the government it's an instrument of statecraft. So, it's a multi-billion dollar industry for a reason, because it's about control of society and commercial interests and political interests, at the very heart of it all.
Do you think the United States will ever be in a position where there won't be censorship? Because what you're describing today, it's really showing like a ramp up towards massive censorship. We're already in it, it seems like, but it seems like it's just going to continue to grow. Do you think that there's a way to turn this backwards?
Yeah, in some respects, it has been turned backwards modestly. In the past year, there's been 8 to 10 different pretty incredible developments in this space that have really created the first cultural and political pushback against the censorship industry in now the 8 years of its existence. Remember, before 2016, censorship was never a job. You couldn't make $20 million a year.
Like we're living in Orwell book. It's insane.
Right. But, take heart. There is, just this week, the front page of the New York Times on Monday, they mentioned me by name 24 times in a single piece, arguing that myself and others are winning the war on disinformation, are winning successfully because of what's happening right now at the legal and at the regulatory and at the policy and at the media levels. But you know, this is going to be with us for the rest of our lives. The genie cannot be put fully back into the bottle. You know, this is going to be like nuclear weapons in a sense. There's always going to be a threat of it. It's always going to be lurking in the background, even right now in the Ukraine-Russia story. You know, this is one of these things that's constantly intermediating the battle. You can't go too far in this fight because then someone's going to break out.
I see it. I was going to ask you, like, you talk about the situation in Ukraine, but like, I would imagine right now something similar behind the scenes is happening as it relates to the Israeli government and unseating Netanyahu.
Netanyahu.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we could go on for that. Yeah, that's a 3-hour discussion right there.
So Mike, what I do at the end of each show is basically incorporate the name of the show, Some Future Day, into the beginning of a sentence for my guests, and then the guest ends the sentence. So I would love to do that with you. I know I'm putting you on the spot a little bit. I won't make it too difficult, but are you game?
I'm game. Let's try.
So in some future day, government's access to leveraging social media to influence elections globally will
be contained.
Perfect. I love it. Is there anything else, Mike, that you wanted to cover today?
No, I would just say the best place to follow me is on X at Mike Benz Cyber. And my investigative work through our foundation is foundationforfreedomonline.com. I'm appreciative with how generous you've been with your time with me, and really enjoyed this conversation.
Incredible insight. I really appreciate it, Mike. It's really great to meet you, and I hope we can continue to speak and get to know each other and have you back on some future day at some time.
Brilliant. Would love to.
I know your time is very important, so thank you so much for joining me today. For ongoing insight surrounding these important topics, you can join the conversation on my social media channels, including Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, at Mark Beckman. And to sign up for my newsletter on Substack, you can find me at markbeckman.substack.com. To make sure you don't miss a show, be sure to subscribe to Some Future Day across all major platforms worldwide, including YouTube, Spotify, and Apple. Special thanks to New York University for producing Some Future Day, and a big shout out to my producer extraordinaire, John Boomhoffer, for being patient and always encouraging me to push through. Thanks a lot, John. Have a great day.